bad decisions continue to be a bigger problem than bad skills. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aeronews. Welcome in to the Aeronews special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot, also a Bob Miller flight training, a Part 141 school in Western New York. We're here to talk safety issues as we do many Mondays, and Bob, we appreciate your stopping by.
Well, Paul, it's my pleasure.
You had an article in the October issue called Bad Decisions Continue to Plague Us Pilots. Talk about why this is an important case for us to take a look at and what the benefit could be to the rest of us.
You know, we all are prone to good and bad decision-making. Unfortunately, most of the bad decisions, if we look at them realistically, tend to work out okay. And in many cases, we have to perhaps use a little additional skill reserves to make up for the problems created by a bad decision. But this one that I wrote about was based upon an actual case of Piper Saratoga down in Florida. A couple of years ago, was en route, several people on board, and experienced a fire aloft. And according to the NTSB reports, the fire first was reported as just by the pilot, the ATC, as a smoke coming from up front under the cowl, and he may have seen a lick of flame or something, but the engine seemed to be working just fine. And so the pilot, in responding to ATC, when they give us that two-word question, is say intentions, the pilot asks for the nearest airport. And the nearest airport was some 15 or 20 miles away. And so the pilot opted to continue on to the nearest airport. Well, unfortunately, the fire, which was created by a break in one of the lines serving, the fuel line serving one of the cylinders in a fuel-injected engine, just a small fraction of a break, was burning slowly until it reached a main fuel supply line going from the tank to the engine and ruptured that. And as soon as that ruptured, then he had a full-fledged fire up front, and the windscreen immediately blackened over, and long story made short, the pilot and passengers all died in the wreck. All right, so it begs the question, when do we continue to hobble a broken airplane to the nearest airport versus when do we put it down regardless of a suitable landing site or not? And I think that line is drawn at any point where we have a fire on board the airplane. I believe a fire on board an airplane necessitates immediate action and immediate landing, even over hostile terrain, if it means getting that airplane out of the sky and onto the ground. And so it goes against our thinking. You know, we're problem solvers. We think we can solve the problem. We think we can fix the problem. But in certain conditions like this, an immediate action is required, and there should be no debate about it.
Do you think it matters whether you've got a 1.5 PSI gravity feed system that doesn't put much pressure on these components, or a, you know, four-digit PSI fuel injection, you know, common rail fuel injection system on an experimental or is this just period flat rule?
I think it's period flat rule. In the gravity flow situation, you know, we could be talking about a J3 Cub or a Taylor craft that has fabric materials. I mean, as soon as the fabric starts burning, all is lost. I think a fire necessitates putting the airplane down, at least starting it down. I try to teach the difference between engine failures and engine fires. The main difference is with an engine failure, we pitch up to best glide speed. In an engine failure, we pitch down to get it on the ground as soon as possible. But we're test pilots, and as test pilots, at that point, we really don't know what's going on under the cowling, whether it's reaching a fuel line. The only factor we really have to decide is, do we have an electrical fire or do we have a fuel-driven fire? That could be an issue, and in today's modern aircraft, electrical fires, we may get burning wires, and that in turn can rupture or burn through a fuel line and create a problem. I think all told, anytime we have fire or smoke up front, The rule of thumb, of course, in all cases, is to follow the checklist. Whatever the manufacturer checks, lists in the checklist, follow that. But in addition to that, or supplementing that, get the airplane on the ground right now. Don't try to make it to the nearest airport.
Well, and it's important to note, too, that a lot of times the fire itself is not the issue. If you've got an electrical fire, if you have smoke coming into the cockpit, you can be overcome just as easily from smoke coming off, you know, burning plastic as you can off a burning engine.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I've been told that a hot fire can burn through a wing spar in about 3 minutes. And let's suppose you're at 7,000 feet, and the best you can descend is at 2,000 feet a minute. I mean, do the math, it's still going to take you 3 minutes to get it on the ground. Mm-hmm. And that wing spar breaks before you get it to the ground, you're not going to survive the impact. So, you know, you're really doing a risk assessment at its best. Get the airplane on the ground and suffer the consequences as opposed to running the risk of having a catastrophic failure aloft.
Okay, can you think of any other circumstances other than an engine fire that call for this level of real-time decision-making?
Well, that's a hard one. I suspect a control surface failure, possibly resulting from a mid-air collision or a severe turbulence with thunderstorm penetration. Anytime the control of the airplane is in question, to the point where we may lose control of the airplane, then we have to get that airplane on the ground. Of course, then we start measuring the risks of putting it down in a very hostile environment. But there are very few environments that are truly, truly hostile. In your part of the country, and I've flown a number of hours over the Rocky Mountains and the Continental Divide, I mean, you can get into some bad areas, but if you habitually fly either very high or follow the four-lane highways, even through the roughest of mountainous terrain, bear me out on this, Paul. I mean, I know you can get to some very remote areas out in Utah, but chances are to be over terrain where an off-field landing is not survivable, it's pretty remote. Would you agree?
I would agree. If you have the glide ratio of a brick with feathers, it is possible to fly places out west here where you could at least put it down on the desert floor and survive the landing. All right. Well, you're a flight school operator, Bob. How do we solve this problem? I mean, this seems to be a classic issue of training and, you know, just having this in your mind at all times.
Well, one of the things that we, and I've been a real outspoken critic of the overuse of simulators in flight schools, you know, the tabletop type simulators. But I yielded to some pressures locally from my flight instructors and very harsh winter weather here. We wound up acquiring a Redbird, the smaller Redbird simulator. And we use that extensively now for just this kind of training, emergency procedures training, checklist training. And so we'll put a student in the simulator, and then we'll call out the emergency. And we'll continue to exercise or do that exercise until we're convinced that the student, the customer has an instinctive reaction to what to do. When I say instinctive, he does not even have to think about it. As soon as we say fire, we want to see that airplane. Not even the checklist at this point is pulled. We want to see that fuel shut off. We want to see that airplane pointed down. And then the troubleshooting begins as the airplane is on a rapid descent. So that's one way we can do it. For those without simulators, practice it and practice it and practice it in the aircraft. Just be sure that the student, and what we test for as private pilots is primarily emergency-wise is engine failures and engine fires. And so they need to instinctively know when we call an engine fire, he points the airplane down. When we call an engine failure, he points the airplane up to best glide speed. So it's something that we have to drill into our system so that it becomes almost an innate natural response.
All right. Well, Bob, let's hope there's a lot of that going on. And I wonder, I'm going to pause and do an edit here. Bob, are simulators well set up to simulate this sort of thing, or do you have to just kind of imagine it happening?
No, you can. Well, you cannot create a fire in the simulators that we have, but you can. You can just call a fire. Just say, "I smell smoke. I see flames. Respond." Failures we can do. We can easily fail the engine on the simulator. The sim operator can do that. And that's a little bit more subtle because oftentimes the pilot will not know the engine's failed until he starts seeing a reduction in power or a reduction in airspeed, a loss of altitude, loss of oil pressure on the engine gauges and things like that. And that's good to practice. You can do that very effectively in the simulator. Fire, you must almost have to call it out. Unless I got a smoke bomb from a local novelty store and let it off in the sim room, that would be pretty realistic.
Bob, we always look forward to talking with you on these Monday chats, and we will catch you again next week.
Thanks, Bob.
Bob Miller has been my guest. You can find his free monthly newsletter and more info on Bob Miller flight training using links at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.